Show Me the Science with Professor Luke O'Neill.
Hello, Luke O'Neill here, and welcome to my Show Me the Science podcast. Now, a request came in about 2 weeks ago now, I guess, and I'm very happy to take requests, even though it's not a music show, of topics that you might like me to cover. And this one was the science of music and the science of musical ability. And it came in about 2 weeks ago, and actually, my big passion is music after science, so I was very happy to dig into it. And then luckily, as if the gods are listening in, even though I'm a scientist, so I'm listening to the gods, there was two big discoveries in the past week or so that I came across about the science of musical ability, and that got me. I said, oh, that's interesting, and then I was asked to cover this. I'm very happy to cover this whole topic. Now, we might start with what is music. We all know what it is, of course, but once you dig into it, it's quite a complicated thing, really. Arrangements of notes and frequencies and our brains listen and we enjoy it, or we sing ourselves or play instruments, and it's a very interesting trait. Some people think it's uniquely human as a species on Earth. We especially love music, but as I guess many people would know, some animals like music as well, and you can play music to soothe cattle, for instance, and they make more milk, or you can get dogs to respond to music. So it's not just humans, but us humans have taken it to the ultimate extreme, really. And we've learned how to play music and use music in all kinds of different ways. So probably elaborate use of music would appear to be uniquely human. And then for centuries, people have wondered, what is music for? And there's no clear answer to that, it must be said. They think it might have begun with people just communicating to each other across the valley. They would shout something and maybe modulate their voices. And then maybe that's where singing began. A second idea is a parent and their baby. Often the mother, of course, to soothe the baby with singing, and maybe that does something to the baby's brain and the baby starts to like music as well. That was a second idea. A third one, though, was Darwin himself. Now, of course, us biologists, we love Charles Darwin because he had the theory of evolution. He thinks it's to do with mating. And he thought maybe it was a way to communicate, to attract a mate. And in the other animals do that to some extent, like dogs howling. You know, the usual thing will attract a mate in. So maybe it's to do with mating as well, possibly. No clear answer as to what it's for, though. There's just some ideas. We do know the oldest musical instrument was 40,000 years ago. A bone flute made from a bird's bone was made and found in a cave in the Swabian Jura in Germany. And they reckon that's the oldest example of a musical instrument that us humans made. And that's definitely uniquely human. As far as we know, other species don't make instruments. And we don't think Neanderthals did either. There's no evidence for that yet. And as I guess people would know, is they're a long-distant cousin of ours, and they didn't seem to make instruments. So again, the capacity of us as a species to make a musical instrument seems to be uniquely human. What were those ancient people doing making a whistle or a flute out of a bird's bone? It must have made noises they found appealing. Again, it could be a way to communicate, I guess. But overall, of course, the joy of music is it makes us feel good, I guess, is one idea that we have. It's also a very social thing. We form choirs and we sing together. That's very uplifting. And there's good evidence, actually, if you're in a choir, it's very beneficial for your mental health. There's really good stuff, actually, on people in choirs, lowered incidence of Alzheimer's, which is great to see. And that's partly because of social activity, but it's also concentrating and learning music is very good for our brains. And maybe that somehow protects our brains in various ways is one idea we have there. And if that's the case, of course, if there are benefits to music, if listening to music benefits us, you could see how that would persist in the population. And I'm going to come on to genetics in a minute, but let's say there are genes that predispose us to liking and performing music. You can see why they would persist, because they might give you an advantage over the person who hasn't got the gene. And maybe you will survive an adverse situation. You might form more social units that might defend your tribe or whatever, and other tribes wouldn't have that. So you can see how if it is a genetic thing, that would be selected out through a Darwinian evolution, and that begins to make sense. And remember, every culture, every human culture has music everywhere you go. You can go to any culture at all and music will be a key feature. And I love that idea, like maybe late at night we used to gather around the campfire and start making music together, and again it was a very sociable and pleasant thing to do. And maybe if I was in the Stone Age, maybe I would have been a musician. You never know, playing music or singing late at night. Another thing, before I get to the recent stuff, the Chimane tribe, in South America. They were studied recently. They prefer dissonant music to consonant music. Now, music can be very jarring. And us in Ireland and in Western cultures, we don't like jarring music. And the question is, why is that? It turns out Chimane prefer dissonant music. And guess what? That seems to be learnt. So if you play a baby in the womb even, possibly, although there's not great science around that, but people do that sometimes. But if you play music to a baby and it's only dissonant, it begins to prefer dissonance over, you know, harmonious music. Now, again, you'd like to see more evidence for that, but certainly the Chimane prefer dissonance. And as I say, in our culture, dissonance is jarring. The theme music for The Simpsons is very dissonant, for instance. Or one of my big heroes, Jimi Hendrix, he famously, in Hey Joe, it's extremely dissonant at the start, and it makes us feel uneasy. So that capacity to like dissonant music over other types or vice versa, that seems to be learnt, which is interesting as a trait. I think the other thing I've come across is, why would a minor chord make us feel sad? That seems to be universal, actually. So there's something about the frequencies in a minor chord, and in our brains we interpret that as a sad sound. Now, why would that be? No idea. Again, science must investigate these sorts of things and find out. And then the other thing I want to mention before I get to the recent stuff, what fascinates me is how technology came into music. So, of course, before records were invented, the only time you'd get music was live. And then technology comes along and the first phonographs were made. And that was pretty wild, you know, the notion of this disc. And you stick a needle into it and it picks up the grooves and then generates the sounds. It was wild at the time. And then, of course, next came tapes and tape recordings. Again, very high tech to record sound in that way and play it back. They got superseded by CDs. Anybody of a certain age remember those? And they came along and they were less static compared to records and became much more slicker in terms of sound. And now, of course, look what's happened. The digital age is upon us. And you can go on Spotify now, as you all know, and find any song almost that's been recorded. Imagine what our ancestors would have thought of that. That in your pocket, you have millions of songs that you can access. It seems like magic. It seems outrageous, doesn't it? And of course, Steve Jobs famously pushed for this when he was an Apple. And there's a great scene in the movie about him. He says to his daughter, "I'll put 100 songs in your pocket." And that seemed to be outrageous as an idea. And yet that's what's happened. Now music is freely available. Anywhere you like, if you can afford it, of course. Human ingenuity bringing a lot to us, I guess, and making music accessible to us. The big question is, what's going to happen next with regard to music? I mean, clearly we have our AirPods, haven't we? You can play music anywhere. Will we eventually end up as some kind of avatar playing the music ourselves in a band, in a virtual kind of world, and really enjoying it? Can you imagine? So you might want to hear a Beethoven symphony, and you actually end up in a virtual world playing the symphony with the best orchestra ever. That would enhance our listening pleasure, I guess. And that's a bit of speculation there. So who knows? It's hard to imagine what's going to happen next. Of course, it was very hard to imagine the invention of records and tapes decades ago, wasn't it? And yet that's what came along. So we'll see what happens next with how we play and listen to music. Of course, you can't beat live music. And something very interesting happens in our brains in a room listening to live music. They've actually scanned people's brains in that situation. And it's quite different than listening to music on your own at home. So again, that must be the evolutionary origins of this, whereby we listened collectively, didn't we? And it bonded us or allowed certain things to happen to us as a people listening together and enjoying it, you know. And then the reproduction of music doesn't quite achieve that. So again, it's interesting as a question socially in terms of how we listen to music and how we consume it. Now, the bit that I want to come onto, though, is this recent science. And there's two questions that scientists have kind of answered, which is unusual in a way. But one is, what's the basis for if you're tone deaf? Now, some people are what's called tone deaf. It's called congenital amusia. And what it means is someone who's classified as tone deaf, they can't really tell the difference between notes that they hear, and they can't tell if an instrument's out of tune, for example, that's being played. If they sing themselves, they'll sing woefully out of tune. They can't get the gist of it. And in school many years ago, when they were forming a choir in the class I was in, the teacher got us all to sing together and then listen to us all. And anybody out of tune wasn't allowed to sing in the choir. Shockingly, it was a shame in a way. But that was just if you were tone deaf. You couldn't catch the note, you know. And it turns out that 4% of us are classified as having congenital amusia, which means we're tone deaf. And guess what? There seems to be a genetic basis for this trait. Now, this study involved examining lots of families, and as many as 71 members of 9 different families were examined in one part of it. In another group, there were 75 members of another set of families. And they rated them all in terms of how many people were tone deaf in each family and how many weren't. And obviously, this is a way to get at genetics. In other words, let's say, for example, all the kids of the parents are tone deaf. Does that mean they've inherited certain genes from the parents that rendered them unable to appreciate music? And there is a genetic basis. This study has shown it definitely runs in families. There are families who are basically amusical and have amusia, and it must be genetic based on these family analyses. And of course, that's how we do things in terms of genetics. You try to find out, do things run in families? And then if they do, you can find there's some genetic basis. Now, of course, the trouble is, even though this is a reasonable study, the environment could be very important. So, for example, if as a baby or as a child, you're not listening to music because your parents aren't interested, then you mightn't learn the different tones. And who knows, that could be part of this as well. Although I think they've controlled for that in various ways by using control families where there was music around and the kids still didn't get the gist of it, if you know what I mean. They were still tone deaf. So it looks to be the environmental part is there, but there's also a strong genetic part. And then they don't know what the genes are, though. Let's say that. But certainly there seems to be evidence for genetics. What they did notice was, in the people who are tone deaf, there's a poor connection between what's called the inferior frontal cortex and the auditory cortex. Now, these are two parts of your brain. The auditory cortex is where your auditory nerve goes in and then connects to your brain. You can hear things and maybe detect notes and so on. And that can connect into this inferior frontal cortex. And that connection was less effective in people who are tone deaf. So again, there must be some reason why those connections aren't forming. It could be the genetics and the proteins involved are slightly different and can't form the connection, or maybe they didn't learn and the environmental bit didn't build up those connections. They are the two options. But as I say, the evidence points in the direction of genetics playing a key role, and they're trying to find out what the genetics is. Now, of course, there isn't any particular medical reason for this. It's just a curiosity, isn't it, to scientifically understand why some people will be tone deaf and why not. And then the other very interesting study was about musical ability. Now, it's one thing to be tone deaf. That's way down one end of the spectrum, should we call it here. There are some people who are very musical. They can pick up an instrument and start playing it. They can pick out notes on a piano. If they hear a song on the radio or whatever, they can actually pick it out quickly and play it. Many can't do that. It's a real skill. And of course, again, it could be partly through training. But again, this seems to be genetic. They have found a genetic basis for the really musical, the ones who are really good at doing music. And it was a big study. They examined many people. They tested them with 4 or 5 different tests of musical ability, including even composition. And then the composite of all that was they found a set of genes involved in this ability. And what they found in particular was there's a missing gene, actually, in the people who are really musical. It's part of a gene cluster, which is a set of genes, and it's called the protocadherin alpha cluster. Now, there's a mouthful for you. Try and sing that. But the protocadherin alpha cluster, there's a piece missing. And it turns out if you're missing that piece, that will govern your musical ability. And it's like a set of genes, I guess. And it turns out this set of genes is involved in a thing called synaptogenesis. Now, synaptogenesis is a posh name for interconnectivity between nerves. And if you're missing part of that cluster, you have a low score, actually, a low musical test score. You're less able if there's a bit missing in that cluster. And they think it's to do with forming these connections in our brains. And if you can't form those connections, you won't have great musical creativity and ability. So in other words, if someone is really good at music, they won't be missing this bit, if you like. And the ones who aren't that creative are missing this part of this gene cluster. And then the second thing that was really interesting, I think, was creativity. Now, how they measure that, I'm not sure, but they could measure the creative abilities of people playing music. Now again, that's a bit subjective, but the ones who are more creative, who could play that guitar very emotionally and connect to us as an audience, I guess, or could also compose a bit, because they tested that, had a duplication in the gene for glucose Mutarotase is the name of the gene, glucose mutarotase, which is an interesting gene, actually, because as its name suggests, it seems to control glucose. And of course, glucose is a fuel for all our body. It's a very important fuel for the brain. And that enzyme is involved in metabolizing glucose, and it controls something called serotonin. And serotonin, you may have heard of that. It's a neurotransmitter. It's tied into mood. And in fact, antidepressants often prevent serotonin uptake in the brain and allows serotonin to persist. And that can relieve some of the symptoms of depression. Secondly, psychedelics can really kick up serotonin levels. And that's tied into imagination, obviously. And that's quite nice because they've found an enzyme that sort of controls serotonin in glucose mutarotase. So that begins to make sense, because if things like psychedelics give us creative responses, and if serotonin is put into mood, maybe that would tie into creativity and music. And if you have a duplication in that enzyme, the gene for the enzyme is duplicated, you can make more of it, maybe that will alter serotonin levels, and that in turn then makes you a creative person musically. So it's very complicated, this, because that's a very complicated gene anyway, but it's quite neat that it ties into serotonin. And one way to explain creativity musically then is a more souped up serotonin system in certain parts of the brain, and maybe that allows you to be very creative. So even though we give great praise to our wonderful composers and our musicians and our, you know, our wonderfully creative people in the music area, it could be largely genetic and they were born with the right set of genes to allow them to be creative. Now, as ever with these complex traits, and I mentioned this before, it'll be nature via nurture. Now, what that means is you might have that genetic feature of glucose mutarotase being duplicated, but unless you're actually trained in music, it won't reveal itself as you being very creative. Like, in other words, you're carrying the right genetic background to make you very creative. You won't reveal that unless you're taught how to play an instrument in the first place, or learning how to compose on a keyboard, say. You might show creativity as a singer, maybe, but certainly the environment seems to interact with this. And it's that combination then that reveals the creativity. And what that tells us is it's never too late. Very important for kids to learn music, because they can express themselves. And if they happen to have a real skill that could be genetic, they can express that, which would be a wonderful thing for them and us listening to them. And then secondly, of course, learning music as a child is wonderfully beneficial for the brain. And interconnectivity goes up, say, and that might make the child better at other things as well in terms of brain function. So it's really strongly recommended, if it's all possible. And obviously people sometimes haven't got the wherewithal to do this, but certainly if you teach, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 year olds how to play a musical instrument, it can have all kinds of benefits for the rest of their lives. And who knows, it might reveal the next Beethoven or the next Paul McCartney. I had to mention the Beatles. He was extremely creative, obviously. I wonder if Paul McCartney has a duplication in the glucose mutarotase gene. I must ask him next time I meet him. So there you have it, the science of musical ability. And thanks, I think it was John who, the name of the person who sent that in as a request, and I'm very happy to do it, John. I hope you got something from that. A fascinating topic of course, where the research of course continues. So there you have it, the science of music. Now, just to plug my own show for a minute, every Wednesday night 8 to 10 on Dublin City FM 103.2, I've got my own music show. And music is my big thing after science, and I play my favourite tunes. So do try and tune in to my show. It's called Resonate, every Wednesday night, 8 p.m. on Dublin City FM. And thanks as ever for listening. And of course, my podcast is a News Talk production, available for download every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.